Campbell, and I am one hat. I'm a filmmaker, filmmaker artist, and I'm also a web producer and web consultant. I work with a number of clients. Lux is one of my clients. I've worked with animate projects, ad agencies like Imagination, and broadcasters like Channel 4. So I'm pretty, use the word promiscuous a lot, but I'm pretty promiscuous in my work. Today I'm going to talk about Lux Online, which I've worked with from its inception to launch and continuing survival. It was started in 2001 as part of the New Opportunities Fund, and we decided to focus it down to be an educational resource for British film and video artists. A lot of people ask us, is the work on Lux Online a reflection of what's held in Lux's physical object archives? It isn't. There may be a bit of overlap, but we decide with Benjamin Cook, who's the director of Lux, and Lucy Reynolds, who's the content manager, based on Lux's overall strategy, the artists that are represented on Lux Online. But the people that we targeted for the use of Lux Online are students from A-levels upwards, researchers, curators, anybody that needs to have information about British film and video art. One of the things that when we first started in 2001 was that when we did our research, we found people, particularly who are teachers, didn't have access to this material, and that's something Stephen was talking about, access to film and video art. They had access to what was readily available, and what was readily available was stuff in Blockbuster videos. This is what we were told, and so we have information around the art, but also streaming video online. The kind of information we have on Lux Online are video clips, which people can see. There's an issue with the video clips. We don't show whole films. We've introduced showing one whole film a month, but we tend to show clips of people's films. This is because we work very closely with artists, and they, for copyright reasons, for the reasons that Felicity mentioned, are quite reluctant to have their whole works streamed online. And also there's a context in which they're seen as well. You know, a lot of the artists that we talk with are very cautious, I suppose, about having work that's meant to be in a gallery or single screen in cinema then shown on the web. So, you know, it depends on the artist. It's not universal, but these are issues I'm just raising about putting stuff that's used one way online. We have images associated with the work, and obviously associated metadata, which can be used for searching. The screening and exhibitions information, a bibliography associated with each artist, and of course their biographical information. In addition, we have work that has been written about the artist that's been published on the site as well, so that people have a kind of notion of artists having context in a body of work. We also generate assets, which means we commission additional works on the site. So it's not just what's available already, we make material to put online. So we commission individual essays for each artist, which are associated on the artist site. We have educational tours like how to use Super 8. You know, that's one of our most popular tours, actually, because a lot of students seem not to have access to that information, and they click on that one a lot. Artistic tours, which are more kind of conceptual tours written by artists or writers or curators using the material from the site to generate another space in a way, which kind of is like, you know, your reference to spatially looking at things. And this is one way they draw the material from it, and they make kind of imaginative essays, poetic, kind of just using the material. We have a history section, which is pretty straightforward, just delineating moments in British film and video art. Themes is another way. When we did our usability tests, which I'm really strong on when doing web projects, a lot of people don't do them, but I think they're quite useful. Themes are quite important for people who are not familiar with the work, but are familiar with areas of works that they want to teach on, or they're just generally interested in. Because we didn't, you know, I think the thing about film and video art that we wanted to get away from is that kind of way in which it becomes just for a few people and not branching out to people who are, you know, not aware of it, but just want to get in a bit more in a gentler sort of way. And may not be coming from the academy, but coming from outside in like lifelong learning. So we thought that was another way of getting into the material. We have images associated with text that sometimes we ask for use on the site. They may not be associated with any of the artistic works, but we like them and we want to use them on the site, and we ask permission from the copyright holders. Recently, I've implemented the use of vodcasts, because one of the things that happens is that we have all these artists and we never hear from them. When I say we never hear from them, you know, unless that you are being taught by them in college, or you go to an exhibition where you see them, you don't hear their voice, you don't hear what they think about their work. So, and in addition, because I know not everybody learns through reading, not everybody learns through text, some people learn visually. So I implemented the use of vodcasts, and our latest vodcast is with Chris Welby. What a vodcast is, it's just a small video which can be downloaded and used on your mobile phone. I've got one on my mobile phone here. If anybody wants to see it, I can show it to you. And on an iPod, or you can look at it on your computer screen. So we make those, and it's freely available. You don't have to pay for it. It's another digital native thing. I'm looking at Felicity, my favorite. But it's just to make, you know, people aware of those artists and their work. Just to give you a brief bit about history, which is, you know, an issue with collaboration and thinking about collaboration. We were in a consortium with the BFI, and it's called Screen Online, and they were the lead organization. We're tiny, they're big, we're poor, they're rich. Well, and that's like a fact of life, do you know what I mean? So you've got to think in those terms as well. Now, one of the major things that they did is they provided the asset management system, which was phenomenally expensive, and we piggybacked on their asset management system, meaning that all our materials was held in this database that fed to the site. But and that was really good for us. It's really good that they were in the lead, because they, in relation to us, are quite a powerful organization. The cons were that this asset management system was the most clunky, heavy thing to use. I mean, they had issues with it as well. It was kind of made for, specifically made for the project, but it had no way of moving with the times. So, you know, like when we started, Web 2 was, you know, was a mind in O'Reilly's head, you know, it was just probably a twinkle of an eye in O'Reilly's head. So, you know, there was no notion of sharing community, YouTube, nothing. And the other thing was access, because it was their content management system we were piggybacking on. We didn't have direct access to our assets online. So it's something to think of in collaboration: who has access, who has control. Especially when you're doing it with like technical partners, you know, how do they train you up and things like that. All those are kind of things to think about, which we learned. But, you know, they're cool with us, we're cool with them, we work with them all the time. We've got a really good relationship with them, but I'm just kind of like letting you know about the kind of the pitfalls and the ways to do it. We have 98,000 individual clips of video. That's a lot of space. It's a lot of time to do stuff. We're very rigorous in the material that we choose. which takes time, and this is an issue which I'm going to talk about later, us choosing or the world choosing what goes up. And in the 5 years that we've done it, the price of hosting has decreased. So we've moved us, we kind of wrenched our way out of the BFI hosting, and now we're hosted by a CMS called Apache Cocoon, which we use. We feed it with a FileMator database, which is based on our site. And FileMaker doesn't cost a lot. A lot of people probably have it already. And Cocoon is open source and free. And this just shows you, like, this is Janan Al-Ani's filmography, which is just what it looks like in FileMaker. But it looks very different when you put it through the web, through the content management system, and through HTML. So basically, I just wanted to show what you see on the database is not necessarily what you're going to see on the web. So these are the kind of things I just wanted to go through with to think about kind of online archives, assets, whatever. There's a notion of user-generated content versus curation. This is a debate we have at Lux all the time, and it's political, it's artistic, it's something that will be an ongoing debate for each and every one of you. The use of semantics or folksonomy, organizing content, how it actually looks when people see it, how they access it, the use of social networking and social bookmarking, which we have incorporated onto us. I mean, I don't know if any of you guys personally have social network sites like MySpace or Facebook. I'm sure you do, and some of your organizations might do. I know Tate does, because you're one of our friends. And also big thing is community, which people kind of often forget about, but that's what drives it in the end, and that's our aim, actually, to build community, to build debates around that. So a lot of you will be familiar with the user-generated sites like Blip, like Google Video, YouTube, iBiblio. These two here, Babel Gum and Arts Online, are curated. They're user-generated, but they have specific, what would one say, specific agendas. Babel Gum is only for independently produced shorts, anything that's professionally produced. You can't just put it up there because you've shot some kids on the swimming pool. Like in YouTube, you can put anything up. They won't let you. And they also curate online film festivals. And Spike Lee, one of the filmmakers you might be familiar with, is behind that. I'm showing you stuff that's not necessarily about art, but it's to show you what exists and how people use it, different strategies. Arts Online Film Archive, I think, is University of Westminster. They've got an artist online archive. But the things I wanted to talk about was these whole things about the wisdom of crowds. Has anybody heard of that?
No.
The wisdom of crowds, basically about user-generated content, which means that this guy, I can't remember his name now, wrote this book. His name is James Sewer Vicky. He wrote a book called The Wisdom of Crowds, Why the Many Are Smarter Than the Few. Now, this is the tension between user-generated versus curated, because with curated tours or collections, it's usually a few people that do it who have specific knowledge in that area. With things like YouTube or Google Video, it's crowds. Also, there is a tendency, a lot of time, I was in a debate about the new queer underground at the London Lesbian and Gay Film Festival, and one guy was saying he puts his films online for loads of people to see and then debate about it. And then if loads of people like it, that means it's good. If only one person likes it, that means it's not good. Now, as we know, in the art world, that's not necessarily the value judgment that we use. We don't use the wisdom of crowds. But if we're going to have user-generated sites, we have to think about that notion of how then do you moderate from the user putting stuff up onto your archive or onto your collection or whatever. What's their motivation? What's their, you know, what's their artistic credibility? If you're using that as your measurement of it. So that's something to think of and take away. The great thing, though, about user-generated sites is that you don't have to worry about putting the content up. The content just generates itself, and you can generate volume. And volume is what makes communities grow. So, you know, it swings and roundabouts and pros and cons and ways of looking at it. Now, it brings me to the issue of rights, which Felicity rightfully mentioned. All the work in Lux Online is agreed and contracted with the artist. All the text, all the images, all the videos, we contract them. We won't go online until we've contracted the artist. So they agree. All the stuff they've given to us, they own, they have the copyright for, so that we can then put it online. So we're not liable. That's one of my jobs, to deal with contracts and to deal with rights. So I make sure that that's fine. And that might be something that you want to think of. With the notion of Creative Commons and copyleft, some artists, we don't have any artists that use copyleft at the moment. There may be another generation of artists that might just, you know, make material that can be reused, that can be redistributed freely. But if you go on the Creative Commons website, there are levels of how copyleft can be used. You can have things available that are not remunerated. You can have things available that are then remunerated. There are different licensing levels, so you know that's something to think of. The other thing is quality control. With things that are user generated, like in YouTube, there's no quality control as such, but more like content control. So that, you know, they won't do anything that's pornographic or sexual, and anything that allegedly you don't own the copyright for. But you know, you've seen like MTV videos stuff up there, and you know it's not, you know, or film clips. You know it's not coming from Warner Brothers or something. It's coming from my guy who's got a computer who's uploaded a clip. Yeah. So these are the things. Also, the tension between user-generated and curated. When you curate something, you have control over the quality that goes up. And with YouTube, it's automated. Like you can't upload anything that's more than 100 megabytes. With Blip TV, you can upload much more in length. And with some, you can upload like 90-minute films. But it just depends on the quality. That allows you then different types of quality, and you have to investigate which one's best for you. But if you have an online archive, you might want to decide, this is my level of how I'm going to represent the images online. And we use 72 DPI, which is just normal for all material, all JPEGs. But for our videos, we encode between 300 and 400 bitrate, because we find that looks the best, and it doesn't stutter, and it's really good quality when you see it online. As I said, the amount of content is affected if it's user-generated, more less content, because you have to curate it. You have to go through it and look at it and make sure it's what you want to go up. And we work closely with the artists. So we have to wait for them to come in. They choose their clips. We encode them. They approve them before we put them up. So we do work very closely with artists. So it's not like, give us your material, bye, see you later, and then we put it up. We work closely with them. So those things do take time. And I wanted to introduce the notion of wiki. I don't know if, do people use Wikipedia here, or do they use wikis at all? Do you use wikis? Because it's not only having stuff, it's being able to alter the stuff that's online. So if your archive is based on wiki technology, then people coming to it can add their own entries or go, no, do you know what, that wasn't shown in 1995, that was shown in 1998, blah, 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 I was there. So, you know, things are not just, I guess, when you're online now, you have to get away from the notion that it's a fixed thing like that, like a text, like the text that we have, when we see it, it's fixed. When we see books and magazines, it's fixed. With stuff on the web, because of Web 2, it's no longer fixed. You can control what can be manipulated or not, but that's just something to think about. I wanted to just throw into the pot. Then folksonomy. We want to introduce folksonomy to Lux Online because, interestingly enough, when we use a controlled vocabulary, that is, we determine what keywords are used in our metadata. Those are the keywords that come out of our head. They're not coming out of a machine. They're not based on gesture or something when you feed the video or the text through a machine and then out pops, you know, keywords. We're thinking of those keywords in our heads, and we are just we. But the thing with folksonomy and tagging, it's that it's a collaborative use of nomenclature, and it's user-generated. So when people come to the site, they will use certain search words to look for content on the site. They may not be words that we've put up, but they're words that they use. And so we want to be able to utilize their imagination as well to aid searching through the site. Random stuff in that makes no sense. So it's not, you know, it's not without its drawbacks. Although it is intuitive and it's very easy to use, but these are things to kind of think through. This is a little screen grab from a site called Woofy. Woofy.com organizes their content visually, because we often think of sites as having navigation left, right, and clicking on things, and that takes you somewhere else. But it's a site for art and photography. And basically, you click on the countries where you see they've got the little dots, and you find out more about the art there, as opposed to looking at text. Delicious, I don't know if you know that social bookmarking site, uses text to visually lay out their information, and they use tags. So if you look at that, just look at the homepage of Delicious, and you'll see it's very different to that. But I wanted to show a visual one, because more often we see text-based stuff than visual kind of navigation. And that kind of made me think of Stephen's talk in, you know, using like how things look and how things are similar visually and movement-wise. And then maybe the technology that can do that, you know. One day we might be able to walk into a room and use our eyes and our thoughts to manipulate the interface. That would be good, wouldn't it? It'd be good for usability for people who are not very motor able to use stuff, which is something that we find. Okay, we've taken to using MySpace and Facebook as a way of building a community around Lux and Lux Online. You know, there's a tendency sometimes to really diss these things, but actually, I personally think they're really useful, and I'll tell you why. But MySpace is it's the most popular social networking site in the US and in the UK, and it's closely followed by Facebook. Okay, we get 20% of our traffic to our site from MySpace. So it's not without consequence that we use it. And the demographic that we get through MySpace is not the people that would normally come into the Lux. So in a way, we're reaching a different constituency. Because the demographic that uses MySpace in the UK tends to be between 18 and 28. And that, you know, that's not without consequence in getting people of a certain age group to your site. There's not more to say on that except, you know, SEO, search engine optimization. A lot of people just think it's about putting in keywords. It's no longer about doing that. To have something online, why call it I can't find anything? It's because just because you're there doesn't mean, one, people know you're there, and when they get to your place, it doesn't mean they actually know how to find stuff. So everything on our site is about people coming to it, staying there, and also finding stuff when they're there. And we don't assume people know the names of artists. We don't assume people know bodies of work that we might, you know, we might talk about found footage or, you know, certain kinds of filmmaking. That's our jargon, but that might not be the jargon that's used by, sorry, A-level person who comes through MySpace. Does that make sense? And it's always it's a work in progress. You know, when we started, there was nothing like this. We were just a flat website, and we still are. And we need to move into being less flat, in a way, more dialoguing with the users that come to the site, because that's how communities are built. Oh, it's not moving. We also enhance our search engine optimization by using Delicious. That's a Delicious interface. When I was talking to you about the text-based stuff, as opposed to the visual. And these are examples of other social bookmarking sites. Basically, there are bookmarks that people have on, you know, when you bookmark something, you can just bookmark it for yourself, which is antisocial, or you can bookmark it and share your bookmarks with other people, that's social bookmarking. And basically, people look through the tagging at other people's bookmarks and they find interesting sites through that. Now, I don't know if you're aware of how the internet works. They've got little spiders and robots that go out indexing websites, okay? And a lot of search engines rely on that. But the spiders and the bots don't see all the sites. There's some sites that people see before the spiders get to it. So if they've tagged it and you found it, then you're onto a site. So it's also a way of getting people to know your site. So we don't have a Delicious account called Lux. You would never know it was ours, because that would be like really dumb, wouldn't it? It's like people know that you know they want to come to our site, so it's through another name, and that's how we put it out. Yeah, you have to be careful with these things though, social bookmarking, because sometimes spammers can use it for just putting up random stuff using popular search words, which we all know what those words are, and therefore enhancing their sites on the web too. So, you know, everything has pitfalls. And of course, the same thing as with the tagging, people misspell things. There's no hierarchy, so, you know, if you see a tag called, I'm a bourbon drinker, so I'll use that. You'll see bourbon, and then you'll see Maker's Mark. Now, if you don't know about bourbon, you won't know Maker's Mark is a bourbon. You'll just see bourbon, then Maker's Mark. So there's no way of interlinking the relationship between the different tags. So those are drawbacks to it. But it's there as a tool. I'm just showing the tools that are out there that we've used. And last but not least comment, community. There's this wonderful site called librarything.com. I don't know if anybody's seen it. It's a site where it's like an archive, well, they're all archives, but you can go in there and put up all the books that you've got or all the books that you love, and you find out if you have in common with other people those same books. They could be obscure books. I've put the most obscurest books, and I found somebody who loves that author. One of my favorite authors is Marie Corelli. Hardly ever heard of. Well, you know, people just don't know. And there was like one woman on there who loved Marie Corelli. I was like, whoa, that's really cool. And they've got something called the Zeitgeist, which shows the most popular books that people are looking at the moment. You can communicate with other people, you can share your links, you can put it on blogs. You can create a profile that you use to then share whatever you want to share. And you can also add it on Dig, Facebook, so that people in your Facebook community can also see your library.thing. It's the same with Shelfari. I don't know if people know Shelfari as well. That's a similar thing, but more visually based. But I think the great thing about librarything.com is it's got authors' information as well. So if you really love an author, there's information about their agent, like how you contact them. It's just huge. So what I wanted to throw out there was that there are more ways to look at the space of archiving than just having it online or having it in a database when you think of digital archives. But also, with each wonderful toy comes consequences, and within our world of art there are issues that need to be discussed, you know, as Felicity raised around rights, but also around user-generated versus curated material. I think that's one of the biggest debates, actually, because we're very protective of the world and protective of quality and knowledge in that way. And if you come from the open content philosophy, that goes against it. Open content philosophy is about sharing everything for everybody. Anybody being able to upload and generate content. So it's kind of something to think about. I want to end in talking about thinking in terms of when you've got your material, where do you hold it? I spoke initially about content management system that I use. On the little image grab there, there's Joomla, which is an open source content management system used for websites. But there are loads, you know, there are loads, Typo3, things that are based on MySQL, things that are based on PHP 5, which, got a good programmer, they can program for you to then use for your database. Usually they create dynamic content, so which means you don't have to code in stuff every time you're putting something up. But what's very important and interesting is you can have multiple content creators. So it's not just one person who's going to be involved in putting material online. And if you've got a lot of material, that's really important. You might have like a super administrator who has access to really important things, but then you have, you know, people who are maybe artists or researchers or students all working to generate content for your site. Some people use content management systems as a kind of digital asset management in which they can store their files for finding later on. Now there's this thing which I'm really very kind of keen on. I kind of think of another word, but it's a lot of people have stuff, but digitally, but it's not in any order. That's why I can't find anything. It's there on the computers or on the drives or on the servers, but how can they find it? And I would implore people to make sure you use a digital asset management system in which you can find stuff, but also you don't duplicate assets, because what happens a lot in organizations with different departments is that people are not aware of what other people have because they're all in different places, and it's just a waste of resources to keep duplicating assets the whole time. But also, if you have a good digital asset management system that's secure and centrally located, you can share it with other people. So if you've got, you know, a video that you want to send to the States or whatever, it's there, you can then send it out to somebody who's asked for it, or a logo. It's just simple stuff. You know, be surprised how you can use it, and also use it within departments to share assets without wasting time by creating them over and over again, or wasting time by trying to find them, which is where a lot of people, you know, waste time, really, just trying to find stuff. So, yeah. So those things are very important, and I would say please try. Even if you don't have a content management system, make sure you've got good digital asset management. And so I'll end it on that, and I guess we'll be rethinking a lot of stuff based on what Stephen said, but I hope I haven't made things complicated, but we can have a discussion later about it all.
I thought that was an extremely good way to follow up, and very logically, actually a kind of practical example of what happens that is intellectually informed and very practical. Great, and again set up a whole lot of points I think that everybody shares for discussion. Fantastic. It's quite tiring, actually. And it's actually 10 to 1 as well. So I think it might be a good point at which to say to people, what would you like to do? What would you like to kind of quickly move into the discussion, or at least to say the things that you feel are really important that have come up from this to discuss, and then have something to eat. I mean, it might be a good idea just to kind of go around and say, what are some of the things that really now come out of this, just even tagging those points, what comes up that we think we really want to kind of focus on, because it's such a big area. And as you can see, for us, we're thinking about how we might generate a project which we'd like to be collaborative. And for everyone else in the room, I think that there are both philosophical, conceptual, artistic, intellectual issues, and some terribly ordinary issues, like how do I use X, that I'm So should we just do that? Pat, can I just start with you, because I can kind of see
I just thought it was fascinating, because I think we saw some very different dimensions of the same issue, and I think and so many of the things that were raised were things that are very much preoccupying us within the institutional repository discussion particularly. And it is that thing of, and it is that thing really all about the living archive. And how you actually balance all those differing needs that allow you to respect copyright issues and so on of the artist that generated some of the content that's in that archive, make it accessible and make it alive then and generate new work. So it's about how to get that to work in a kind of continuum. That means everything's working together rather than what we are aware of now, which is, you know, all the tensions that currently exist. And I think that's for us where having dialogue is absolutely key, and working collectively together on these things rather than in our separate silos, as you said, all the different things that are happening in an institution that aren't coming together, is absolutely critical. And I think, you know, this is a very good starting point actually in terms of getting us all together in this room, and I think there could be lots of interesting conversations that will flow out of today as well as during the course of today. I mean, that's my kind of big thought at the moment. And you know, things like the whole issue about control and, you know, is it user-generated content, or is it about curate? You know, there's so many tensions there. And it is all about the, in some ways, so much about the impact of Web 2 technologies on make us rethink the traditional approaches. So, I mean, yeah, they're my initial kind of big issues, thoughts.
Thank you, that's great. Molly, what about you? Where are you coming to interviews?
I can only really speak on behalf of my experience with Isaac, and just to reiterate, the points that you both made. On the one hand, Isaac gets very nervous about putting his work out there online because it can jeopardise certain exhibitions or showing his work in other contexts. But on the other hand, he's really aware that once he's done a film and it's shown in certain galleries, he doesn't want to lay it to rest. He wants to actually make the archive, a living thing. And so he's talked about the possibility of actually putting it into, a touring exhibition or something like that. You've mentioned the Stanley Kubrick exhibition. And that would be something he'd want to do, but obviously be in control of it himself and not just pass it over to the institution to do that for him. So it'd be interesting to talk about that.
So there's another kind of issue of on how artists interface with what the control, what the anxiety is.
There's also the issue of because of that access. Because in a way, I've got put in two camps. It's like, if you're teaching, you want access to material. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what the economics of obtaining material to show is. I know resources are strapped, and so if certain artists are making their work available and other artists don't, then they're the ones that get seen and talked about, blah, blah, blah. It's a whole kind of political economic debate as well, isn't it? It's not just what's physically there.
But artists need to make a living, so they need to
absolutely
charge some amount of
that. Absolutely.
Are there other things, Adam, things that sort of strike you, for instance, that you kind of think we really need to look at, talk about?
I think just what Felicity was talking about earlier, in context and things like that, I think the important thing is that the artists have to archive the technology as well, not just the work. So we need to keep the work has to be shown on a monitor, for instance. They need to keep that particular monitor themselves rather than relying on other people to do it and to show it like that. So I think that's quite important. And also is linking between different websites as well, I think they're very important. Which is something that's not done, and links can get broken as well if things move around, even though it was done properly at the time. I think that's quite important.
Other things, I mean, Andrew, you must have a lot.
Well, I think a lot of it was, what I could see is everyone's putting up material, there's material around, and I think, as you point out, Cam, is trying to find that material, really.
Okay.
I mean, that's going to be, I think, a key thing. How do you locate certain material, if we've got something over in that archive or something in that archive, something like that kind. But also, I think with the technology that's coming up now, where you could just pull out material from all these different places and use it yourself. So, say a repository might have an interface, but does that interface really, is that really going to matter in the future? Because there's going to be other technologies where you just draw the material out and present it in a different
just
way.
Just scrape the data.
So for a repository, I think our thing is we're just maybe storing it, looking after it. We are a repository. For then people to use it in a different way, or do we go along the line of having all these other Web 2 technologies to have people come to our site, or whether we're just an area that people take material from. I think that's it. Mm-hmm. So that we've got to think about.
A big one.
Can we just go around further? Martin, what about you? And you talked about the interface between boxes of material and this kind of ongoing project at the Slay. Are there particular points you'd like to kind of investigate?
It's kind of been collected informally because
There's the formal Slade archive, which involves the Strand print room, which buys paintings. That's a proper collection. And a lot of material goes into the official UCL archive, which is held somewhere in a big warehouse. But the work that we've been informally collecting is what we consider good student work on graduations, like we're asked for copies. But because it's been going on for 15 years, there's formats which we can't play, or there's programs stored in on discs which we can't read, and operating systems we no longer have. So the main problem is, where do we start with all of this stuff? Is it even worth doing in the first place? Because there is a lot of important work in there, but most of it's probably not worth the effort of archiving at all, really. So they're the kind of, that's as far as we've got at the moment.
But that's the interesting thing also in terms of the thing of what is an archive, and should it be selective and so on, or should it be about everything? So who's to say in the future, you know, what will be of interest? So so when it is the question, what is it, is it worth, how do you make those decisions?
Going back to digital asset management, our web server is 15 years old as well, and nothing has ever been deleted off it. So it's a matter of going through and trying to work out what stuff is, because a lot of the older stuff was just put on there in any old way before anyone understood what was going on, just as experimentation. And often it's hard to work out who put it there, what it was meant to be doing, should we keep it, what does it do, and how do we show it to people as well.
That sets up another set of very interesting issues as well, about almost like the archaeology of the work. There's a lot of contemporary archaeologists now working on that stuff. David?
I was just going to do, I mean, that last remark made me think that actually the dispersal of assets through a whole range of archives is, in one way, terribly important, because it stops a single central censoring or editorial body from making those decisions about what's kept and what's not. You have a greater hope of having a diversity of material maintained if it's dispersed amongst a lot of different collections. This is just a thought that occurred to me as you were speaking. It may be a problem that you have, and you are probably the only people who can make those decisions about what to hold on to and get rid of in your collection, but actually it's good that you're doing it, it's good that you're independently making those decisions.
Well, our policies do not delete, so,
well,
then
good,
how do we
work good for
out?
You, but...
That's another question about authority and curation, isn't it, in a sense, and the question of dissemination and dispersal.
Yeah, but that's also why it's terribly important to have a network of all these different collections, so that researchers can actually discover this diversity through these different collections.
I think you can have linked websites to dilute it. And, you know, I think you find the appropriate archive and you try to ensure that that is maintained, whether or not there is other material in other archives. Surely one of the points of today is about stuff that is in properly archived, that linking websites. Just speaking on behalf of someone who had to deal with Ian Brakewell's fellowship here and setting up something I didn't want to do, I have to say, which is to do a website, a diary reinvented website. But having done it, then ensuring things properly linked. I just want to say one other thing. One, I'm not a kind of great rights moralist. I've done my share of linking. But what I was trying to say when I made that interjection was partly to do with rights, but it was control. Mm-hmm. And as I operate as the estate of an artist, when you talk of the idea of clips, so I'm quoting Ian now, it's not necessarily my views, is that when you make a film, it's a very simple thing and you can authorise clips because that's what you do with them. When you make an installation and it becomes an artwork, the clip is somewhere inappropriate because that does not represent
the experience,
whether it's an immersive experience or whatever, of what that installation is. And I have that. That was Ian's kind of credo. Then, can I just finish? Then, I was working with Dave and Illuminations for this BFI DVD, and I was very unhappy at the way the kind of interview section and the way they were using extracts and the whole areas of Ian's work wasn't on somehow on that DVD. And in fact, it took Ian's gallerist, Anthony Reynolds, to persuade me to go against all that thing that I knew Ian held dear, which is, he said, although The Other Side and Onward are both installations, you need to have those clips on there so that people can see it. So I overrode all my, and I think that's going to be something that Isaac's going to think about, particularly as Isaac, there's a film called Three, which I know exists as a film that goes out in the world on its own, and there's Three that's an installation. So my guess is that, so that's easy, Isaac would say we have a clip from Three. But you're only representing the film version, you're not representing the other version, other than probably a still, so that you can see what Three might have looked like as an installation. So I think, but Isaac's alive. So he can make that kind of thing, but when you are faced with someone who's dead, you know what their wishes are.
Yes.
And yet you know they're not getting the work. Sorry, this is going into the whole world.
Those merging points that are, they're all, I mean, we have those debates at Lux all the time about how do you represent work online, you know, the issues that are raised. Some are meant for single screen, in a cinema, in a gallery, then you show them a clip which has restricted dimensions, or you're showing an installation piece. But what I would say is our site is an educational resource, and people may not have that experience again. They may not be able to see that installation, but they might want to see what it looked like. Mm-hmm. So are you going to prevent them to see what it looked like? Do you know what I mean? Well, I can hear what you said.
No, but you, I think the Lux site's really good, and the way you represent him is good, but it is represented by just a photograph.
Yeah,
I think that's maybe the key, that you make it clear that, you know, what you're seeing. I think this might be one of the challenges in terms of video and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, if it isn't the full work, you have to make it clear. You have to make sure that when people are interacting with that work, they understand that's a representation, not the work. Don't read it as the work itself.
And we work with the artists, so we wouldn't put something up that they didn't want. So we wouldn't have put something up that Ian wouldn't have wanted. Mm-hmm. We consulted with him about that, or Janan, or whoever. We consult with them, and that's, in a way, that control from the artists, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
yes, but I've already established a precedent for Ian's installation work being represented by a clip, so.
You might make a clip-free or a low-quality clip-free, and it allows people to see if they find the work interesting and want to pursue it further, and go and actually visit the archive or purchase the book or the DVD and get the full version. Whereas they're not going to look at that, they're not going to go and make that effort without having some idea of what they're going to be looking at first, or if it's appropriate for them to pursue further. Do you have to make it free to some respect?
It's kind of a raising awareness of something that's there for people then to pursue later on, I think. I think with the clip that we've shown, obviously someone filmed in a way, I mean, obviously it's breaching certain rights, but I mean, it doesn't represent how the work actually looked.
But it's better than nothing at all.
But if I, you know, if someone saw that and said, oh, actually I'd want to go and actually see that, I think someone seeing it, I don't think it's actually, someone's going to substitute it. They can say, right, now I've seen it on YouTube, I'm not going to go and actually see the, you know, if they want to see it. I'm not actually going to go and see it and pay my money to it. I don't think that there's a loss.
I would tend to think most people are kind of sophisticated in their kind of media literacy to understand the difference between a mobile phone clip on YouTube and a gallery installation.
It's like even from old paintings. If you see a still of a Van Gogh, it's not the same as if you went to the gallery and saw it. It's a completely different experience, and I think people are aware of that, even just talking old art.
Can I just finally just ask Nigel what the, are there any other points on that we that's specifically that haven't been mentioned or that come up for you, and then we kind of either have some sandwiches or just continue.
Well, I guess for me, although it would be naive to pretend that the kind of pre-digital archive had been a completely unproblematic institution, it does seem clear that whatever the enormous possibilities and benefits of archiving material digitally, it is going to present very substantial challenges to the institutions. And I guess I'm here because I work for an institution, and I've just been thinking about where the points of, as they seem to me at the moment, the points of particular tension seem to be. If you talk to anybody in a senior position at Tate, they talk about their responsibility to the gallery visiting public, and of course they treat their site as their fifth location. Liverpool's nice, and then you've got Tate online as the fifth site. So that the public visiting Tate is conceived of as including the people who come to it online. Mm-hmm. Tremendous emphasis upon getting the public in and getting them to engage with the works in the collection. But then the other thing that you hear a lot about are the responsibilities to the artist group that they represent. So that it's a rather different situation as it would be from the National Gallery, where all the artists are long gone. You might have champions for particular artists, but you don't actually have the artists. And so they take a lot of time in dealing with that, and it's hugely challenging. So I've just been thinking about how those sorts of tensions might balance when some of the things that colleagues in the room have already pointed to would really come to the surface. For example, that wonderful, flexible, creative potential of juxtaposing, as we saw in Steve's presentation, items of work which are in an archive in new ways and seeing the material differently is something which would appeal absolutely to one side of Tate. But for reasons we've just been thinking about, it might not at all appeal when it's from that other side, the artists themselves. So that's something that's got to be balanced. There's also something which you hear from the colleagues who are the professional archivists about the value of the original context, so that, you know, as it were, the items that go into the archive should be unpacked in a way that matches how they were originally held by the owner. Obviously the flexibility of digital versions just turns all that completely off. You might have a default so it reverts to the original order or something, but that's going to be a challenge. The value of seeing the whole work we've touched on, which I think is an important one. And then one last one would be a very interesting discussion that Tate's now having, which I think is really quite recent. I mean, I've only been there a year, and I think it's probably something which has just started to become important just in the last few months. Not associated with me being there, but I think particularly our new head of library and archive is raising this, is the line between Tate's collection, which is as it were one body of works, which has one group of people looking after it, is intended to have a specific set of roles attached to it, and then the things which are in the archive, many of which could be in the collection. Yeah, absolutely. But there will be. I have complained about for years.
Things
which are in the wrong category,
is it? No, it's the fact that film and video is documentation. It's never bought by Tate as art.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I mean, so it's those.
It goes to the core of my.
Right, those sorts of institutional conventions, really, which is a way of managing business. You know, so you've got curators looking after one sort of stuff, you've got archivists looking after another sort of stuff. We haven't got a third category of stuff at all, apparently, for whatever historical reasons.
So that is so that means that if we're going to be doing research using this material, it's inevitably going to be interdisciplinary research, because we're going to be having single bodies of material which are going to have to be looked at by different people with different skills. Mm-hmm. And again, institutionally, interdisciplinary research is what everyone bangs on about the whole time as if it's easy, but in fact institutionally it's often fantastically difficult because of time and money and attitude and training.
And
so
that, in a sense, that leads back into this question, I think, that we've opened up, which is what kind of space does research really open up? Because it's very easy to get into a kind of reductive space where we think, well, how do you practically do that? But we could think about research as a speculative space where we think about how you can respond to some of those intellectual questions. And think about, you know, Campbell's question of the recontextualization of work. It makes me want to ask what sort of what theoretical and intellectual information, what theoretical discourses actually can help to enable, facilitate, and help us to think in that way, so that it isn't a practical, pragmatical, reductive discussion. Mm. And that I think that's where we want to go. So we're actually thinking about where we might research with and on and through archival material, aren't we? Rather than just how do we then roll it out. And one of the things about Lux Online seems to be it's kind of managed to find this very, very interesting way of enabling community and serious research. Should we have a little break then, if it's not too authoritative? Informal break.
Not too curatorial.
And have a sandwich and sort of that maybe even reconfigure the room so we can actually have that conversation. Let that sink in a little bit and thank Stephen Campbell for both of those, that pairing, which I think is just so provocative and really just was so much. So, yes, let's move to the sandwiches.